Order. Today is April 18th, and welcome everybody. I think we're going to start out today by opening a work session on House Bill 3377. And you come on up, and we have some amendments for that bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for scheduling a work session on House Bill 3377. You should have in front of you dash one amendments. When you had the public hearing on this bill, DMV and I, on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association, by the way, if I didn't introduce myself, Darrell Fuller with the Northwest Auto Trades Association, had met and agreed on some amendments that get us to where we actually wanted the bill to go. This has to do with sanctioning dismantlers who are violating the rules that DMV has established. Current law only allows DMV to issue a fine or to cancel their license. There's nothing in between. And what the dismantlers would like is to work with DMV during the interim, create some administrative rules on stair-stepped penalties based on the severity of the problem and how continuous the problem is with the dismantler. So this will allow DMV to write some rules that would allow them not only to revoke but to suspend a dismantler's license, and also make some statutory reference changes. And so DMV has looked at them, and they're here, and obviously can testify on their own behalf and on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. We would support you adopting the dash one amendments, and thank you for your time.
Jack, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation, and we've had a chance to look at the amendments, and they're exactly what we had anticipated. We're fine with them, and we had, have no problems with this measure at all.
Thank you. Any questions?
Are there any other folks to testify? Do we assume that all these folks then are in full agreement with the dash one amendments? And Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3377, dated 4-18-07, be appended thereto.
Representative Butler has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 3377, dated 4-18-07. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? No. The amendments are adopted. You have an objection?
Off the floor, Chair.
Sure. I move that House Bill 3377 be engrossed for the dash one amendments that be reported to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3377 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Byer.
Aye. The motion carries.
Madam Chair, would this be a consent calendar item, or is there...
concern?
Madam Chair, in as much as this has been through 3 weeks of working out, and that the bill could be construed to be something different by looking at the original version versus the A engrossed, I would encourage this to be, and we are talking about people's livelihoods, and the original bill, it's either black or white, they're either in or out, suspended, or able to continue their livelihoods. I think that it would probably be a better item to have Representative Buckley explain why we made the change.
I was going to recommend Representative Smith and so last for a ride.
I'll carry it. No one wants me to carry bills.
Okie dokie, maybe I'll carry the bill.
Discretion's the better part of valor,
yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Byer will carry the bill. Thank you. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3377 and open a House work session on House Bill 3379.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 3379 has the dash one amendments, which you have before you, which completely replaces the original measure. It narrows the focus to just rented or leased vehicles, so no longer personal property. This puts this all now in the criminal code. It provides sanctions for a person who commits the offense of a criminal possession of a rented or leased motor vehicle. It creates it as a Class C felony. And I just got a quick refresher on the criminal code. You know, based on value of the vehicle as well as the person's prior history, I'm told that that penalty is typically between 30 and 90 days in jail. If it's multiple offenses, it could be as much as 6 months or escalate indeed to 18 months if it's a severe repeat offender. The Dash 1 amendments also state that the offense occurs when a person receives the written demand and knowingly fails to return the vehicle within 3 calendar days from the date of receipt or refusal of the demand, applicable to both rented and leased vehicles. It specifies that a demand is considered refused if it is not deliverable to a person at the address provided by the renter or lessor. It specifies that the written demand may only be made by commercial overnight delivery service that can supply a delivery receipt. And it finally provides that a bona fide contract dispute is a defense against the charge of a criminal possession of the rented or leased motor vehicle. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins representing the Car and Truck Rental Association of Oregon. With me, Kevin Neary, with Enterprise Rent-A-Car General Manager and Vice President. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for making the suggestions at the last hearing that have made this a better bill, and Representative Tomei in particular for suggesting we put it in a separate section, and we have done that, and I think it is now where it belongs. Committee staff gave a very good overview of what the amendments do, and we'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, if I may, two items to start off with. I appreciate the fact that we are now only dealing with cars and this bill, and that the amendments address the concerns as expressed by Representative Tomei relative to the actual delivery. They must receive the written demand in order for this to be effective. I think Representative Tomei, and I don't want to put words in their mouth, also asked questions about what happens if I am not at home from the delivery address at the time because I'm unable to return home with the automobile for some other reason. And I just wanted to make sure that that had been addressed and had been thoughtfully considered. The second question I have deals with the level of the penalty. So perhaps Mr. Elkins could respond to the concern of the must being able to receive the written demand at the location as provided on the original written lease agreement.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I believe we answered that question on page 2, line 8, which says the person shall be considered to have refused the written demand if the commercial delivery service determines the demand is not deliverable to the person.
And Madam Chair, if I may,
follow up.
I think one of the concerns, and again, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but one of the concerns that Representative Tomei had indicated at the time was that sometime that this is for an automobile, or maybe it was originally could have been for almost anything that was of rental value, but now it's for an automobile, and we're on a trip and we're broken down. I guess it behooves us to be in touch with the automobile, I mean, pull out our lease agreement and yes. Give them a call, and I'm assuming that the fine print says, you know, if you have a problem, you're on the road somewhere, call this number, which then provides us some kind of an escape hatch, because at that particular point, through no fault of their own, they're not at home and able to take delivery and service the delivery of a summons.
Yes, and thank you for bringing up those issues. Thank you, Madam Chair. In reading this, and I haven't had a chance to look at this thoroughly, but in Section 1, Sub A, you're talking about renting a vehicle, and in B, leasing a vehicle. And one would think, I mean, if you're renting a vehicle and you're 3 calendar days late, that's very different from leasing a vehicle, and then you've got a period of 45 days that you haven't paid for it. To me, that seems reasonable. And when I brought this up before, it was for other items that might have been rented from Joe's rental, not particularly automobiles. But it seems to me that automobiles, when we're talking about automobiles, that's very expensive equipment. And so this is not a minor incident if someone is 3 days late from renting an automobile or 45 days leasing an automobile. But if, having said that, I'm very concerned about Section 2 and all the amendments, and I guess I'd like some explanation on what that is about.
Madam Chair, if I might, yes. Representative Tomei, Section 2 is just stating that the section that you just talked about is placed within the criminal code. It just places it there. So the only change in Section 2 is on page 2, line 28. You're seeing that this first section of this act is placed into the Oregon Criminal Code.
I think I understand. Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, my follow-up question dealt with the Class C felony and bringing this into the criminal code, and so Representative Tomei's question relative to bringing that into the criminal code is an excellent segue. When we criminalize behavior which was previously not criminalized, frequently there is a fiscal impact, certainly to the counties and the cities, if not to the state. Does this bill then need to be considered for the potential fiscal impact of creating a new crime, the crime of failure to return an automobile, whether it be leased or rented?
Representative Butler, that was a good question, and as I was reading through this, I was kind of wondering about that too, and I guess be careful what we ask for, because then it opens another door that we don't really understand. So I guess my question was, in your opinion, does this bill now have different sanctions than it would have had under the original bill?
Madam Chair, when I look at the original statute, again, Al Elkins, I look at the wording on the original bill, line 30 of section, the first page, and it talks about Class C felony there as well. So I don't know if in fact, but my answer is I think it's the same. I looked at the statutes this morning when we got the amendment and tried to do a comparison, and I believe the wording is the same. So I don't think there is a fiscal. I think everything stays the same in that sense. But for the record, I'm not an attorney. But the same violation applies in the original language, in the original bill, in the original statute, as it does in the and the amendment in relation to Class C felony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Urey with Enterprise. Along with what Al was saying, nothing was really changed as far as penalties. The only thing the industry was looking to do was to shorten the time frame before we could alert the police that there was a bad deed going on, and to open up commercial delivery service as opposed to certified mail, again, to expedite the process. Those are the only two aims of this bill.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And your comment is a segue into, I guess, my concern. I understand that issue. I genuinely do. The concern I'm having, Madam Chair, is I keep thinking about the naive traveler down in Florida or in Hawaii who wants to extend their vacation by 4 or 5 days, and, you know, whether it's being naive or ignorant or what the situation is, just keeps driving the car thinking, oh, I'll pay whatever it is extra when I get back to the rental car place. And I'm just struggling with are we going to be making criminals of people who come to the state of Oregon who want to spend a couple extra days going what was once going to be on the Oregon coast now over to southern Oregon simply because they're naive? That doesn't mean I'm going to vote no on this, but it's a concern I'm struggling with. I think there's a lot of folks out there who, you know, they'll just pay the extra.
Thank you, Representative Smith. I'm personally not as concerned about that piece as maybe you are, because I think that when you rent a car and you sign the agreement, you're pretty much aware of when you've said you're going to return a car, and that if you for some reason decide you're not going to notify them, I do think there you have to take some responsibility on to yourself on that issue.
And I agree with you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking out loud the concern I have.
So
if I may, Madam Chair, to speak to that, Kevin Neary with Enterprise, the industry is relatively small in the number of players that are out there, and certainly as a matter of public policy, we're out to make friends and keep customers in cars who are paying. And I've been in the industry 27 years. I don't think I can think of an example that would fit your concern.
People
pick up the phone after a few days and let you know what's going on, and that's great. That's really all communication is what we're trying to make sure we have.
Thank you. That reassures me.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I was going to comment to Representative Smith. It's never naive to travel to Southern Oregon.
It's a pleasure to it.
And thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think by having called my attention to the fact that currently under the law right now, property at $500 or more is already a Class C felony. That would remove any additional obligation or liability. So based upon that, Madam Chair, are there others to testify on behalf of this bill or relative to the bill?
There's no one else, right?
And we are in a work session.
We are in a work
Chair,
session.
I would move then the -1 amendments to House Bill 3379, dated 4/17/07.
Representative Butler has moved the -1 amendments for 3379, dated 4/17/07. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3379 be engrossed with the -1 amendments and be moved to the floor with the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass motion.
Representative Butler has moved House Bill 3379 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Beyer.
Aye. The motion carries.
Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank staff for holding my hand while the amendments were awaiting the amendments, and I pestered her more than I normally would do, and she was very patient with me, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we need a carrier.
Okay.
Representative Smith. Thank you. And I'll let the audience know if you came for House Bill, and I have to look at the 2851. We were not able to get a fiscal today, and the committee really wanted to make sure that there was not a large impact on this bill, so I'm going to carry it over until Monday. And I thank you for coming and appreciate you waiting. And now I'm going to open an informational hearing. The Department of Transportation Project Delivery Organizational Assessment. So all of you transportation groupies, welcome you.
I love it. The transportation groupies.
Good afternoon. Doug Tindall, Deputy Transportation Groupie for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Today we're here in response to an issue that was raised at an interim House Transportation Committee during the fall of last year. And that question came around our project delivery staffing. And the project delivery portion of the agency of the Highway Division is the part that delivers the projects that you see on the road, the construction portion of the program. The other major portion is maintenance. This deals with the construction portion of the program. 1998, Dye Management Group, located in Bellevue, Washington, did a study of our project delivery organization. They actually did a study of both project delivery and maintenance at that time, made several recommendations, which we have implemented and had implemented, finished implementation of a couple years ago. And so as the committee asked the question, the way we interpreted the question was they're saying, okay, you've made these changes in your project delivery organization. Is it working? Are you staffed correctly? And that was the question that we heard coming from the committee. We re-engaged Dye Management Group to come back and answer that question for us and look at our project delivery organization and make recommendations if there were any for improvement, and identify areas where there are potential weaknesses. Joining me today from Dye Management are David Rose, directly to my left, and Gary Wolvotny, further left, and they will do the presentation, and we'll be available to answer any questions that you might have, so I'll turn it over to David.
Madam Chair, oh, sorry.
That's fine, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tindall mentioned, my name's David Rose. I'm a senior vice president with Dye Management Group, and with me today is Gary Wolvotny. He's a senior associate with our firm. Just by way of introduction and some context for you, we are a management consulting firm that works almost exclusively for transportation agencies at the state and local and federal level, and in that capacity, we conduct these sorts of independent assessments really across the country and bring to this perspective on best practice nationally and apply that knowledge in the context of this study. The paper that's in front of you is a fact sheet which summarizes the project delivery organizational assessment that we've completed that you also have a copy of. And what I would like to do briefly is provide you with some background to the study, just the basic highlights in terms of the findings and what we've recommended. In terms of background, I think as you all know, in about 2004, the department implemented really what was the final phase of a long-term change initiative that was begun in the late 90s to decentralize project delivery, put projects closer to the customers, and in so doing, really improve the efficiency and effectiveness of that process and ensure that it's customer-oriented and that you're building projects that meet the needs of your communities. This final piece is in place now. It's been in place for about 2 years, so it's a very good time to take an assessment, take a step back now that that way of delivering projects is stabilized, and ask some basic questions that relate, which really, in a nutshell, do you have the right staff in the right place, do you have the right types of competences, and is ODOT positioned to continue to deliver excellent projects and exercise their responsibilities as the owners of the infrastructure. A couple of areas of context that I do want to mention which I think are important to this. This change has also taken place during a period in which the overall scope of the department's program has increased. I think as you all know, through about 2001, 2002, the program size was about $240 million or so on average. In the last 3 or 4 years, it has jumped quite considerably to about $350 million. And during that time frame, there have been no increases in staffing. There's also been a good, to some extent, a fair amount of employee transition with retirements and people moving into different positions within the organization. I think that context is important for the study as well. And, you know, when we embarked on that study, the key question that we were looking at was, does the department have the right people in place and the right number of people? And as we conducted our analysis, it became very apparent to us that there was a more important question and really a fundamental finding that we came to through our work, and it is, as we've called out, that the department really does face considerable business risk due to the difficulties that it's facing in recruiting and retaining professional staff at all levels. And we concluded that you can't really ask the question about whether or not the department has the right people and enough of the right people if there is a real inability to recruit and retain the right people. So we looked at that some more, and in doing analysis and comparison to other agencies, both in the state and elsewhere, it became very clear to us that there are some significant issues that arise as a result of this. In a number of the regions, the department has a shortage of specialized expertise and is one deep in many areas in terms of technical competencies, not just in some of the engineering disciplines, but in some of the environmental disciplines, which these days are very critical, as you all know, to project delivery. And there are a number of different areas where that's the case, and they range from air quality through to some of the very specialized engineering functions around, for example, some of the mechanical bridges that the department has. And in this context, if employees retire or they, for whatever reason, are just unable to continue in their positions, the department has no one to backfill them with, and that places them at risk. And in looking at the length of tenure of the current labor force within project delivery, some 50% of the employees now have been with the department less than 10 years at one end of the distribution, and then at the other end, you have some 30% who have been with the department from 20 to 30 plus years. So you have overall a labor force which is, that you will see a lot of retirements, people eligible to retire now, and then you've got a less experienced labor force. And that creates some risk to the department. And I'm just kind of hesitant to be alarmist, but if you look at that and then look at the second kind of overall finding that we've got is that these challenges really do require leadership and attention at this point. From our discussions with management and review of their activities, they're aware of it. There are some steps being taken, but this really does need to be elevated in our opinion. And it's a strategic question for the ability of the department to continue to exercise the responsibilities as the owner of the infrastructure and to manage and deliver what is now a larger program. And as you have those projects in place and open to traffic, to continue to be able to manage and address the life cycle management needs for those assets. The challenge as well that you're facing arises mainly because of what's really a growing compensation gap between ODOT and some of the other governmental agencies with which you compete for employees here in the state. I'm not just talking about the disparity between ODOT and the private sector, but I think also between ODOT and the public sector. When we looked at some of the folks with whom you compete for employees, Portland Department of Transportation, Washington County, Multnomah County, and to the north in Washington County, to the south in California, there is a growing difference in pay, and we've documented that, and in some cases it's as much as 50%. And in addition to that, and what we've also identified is that you have a situation now in which there is a real inability within ODOT to retain top performers. In any organization, your top performers are the people that you want to take care of, are the ones that you want to keep within the organization, and those towards the and your least successful employees, you're not as concerned about retaining them. ODOT now is in a situation in which there is a very large or almost extreme disincentive to progress from the top of the professional engineering scales into management, because to do so means that you take a cut in pay. So if you're ambitious, building your career, and you reach that stage and you're a top performer, the very people you want to compete, then you're likely to move up and out of the organization. And if there are other organizations that have similar culture and are available on your doorstep, well, then why wouldn't you move across to them, whether it's in Portland, in Multnomah County, or to other agencies? And that, as we've looked at the data, done the analysis, that's a real problem. it also adversely impacts the employee morale when they see their colleagues, the people they look up to, and see as high performers moving on. And certainly, as we've looked at the data and the sorts of employee surveys that the department does, that's reflected in some of the issues affecting organizational health. Those were what leapt out at us as the fundamental findings from this assessment. There's more detail in our documents. And we took a step back from that and said, in terms of recommendations, what would we recommend and provide the most the way forward for the department? And the areas of recommendations, and there's a good deal of detail, Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the report on this, but they fall into three areas. Overall, looking at the management and organisation, there are definitely areas in which the department can deploy its existing resources more effectively, and we speak to those. Making human resource management, recruiting, retention, and career pathing a strategic area of focus for management across the organisation, and we speak to how that can be done in some detail. In the area of recruiting, retention, and career paths, the exhibit that we just called out there in this fact sheet, if you are able just to turn to the back page, I think starkly illustrates the career pathing problem that the department has. And those blocks there illustrate, they depict the pay scales for the different positions. And as you see, when you progress up to that PE2 scale, you want to get promoted, you take a pay cut. And by the way, those PE scales are overtime eligible. So it's really not attractive to move into management. And
that's a big cut.
And so in terms of the areas of recommendations, we recommend seeking action to increase that scale and remove that disincentive so that you can keep your top performers. Because with a larger program, with fewer employees, those are the people that you need, especially if you're managing a larger outsourced program, the types of larger projects that you're now seeing. They're the very people that you want, so you need to be able to retain them. So that's a whole recommendation area. And then in addition to that, to address the areas where the department is one deep and to maintain and ensure that you have that continuity of technical excellence, to exercise your responsibilities as the owner, again with the increasing role of the private sector in designing and building transportation in the state, ODOT still has a lot of responsibilities as the owner, and we in our recommendations are recommending that department seeks authority or seeks some targeted number of new positions to address the situation where the department is at risk because they are one deep. And how we've suggested doing that is at the same time is to look at having budget authority or seek budget authority to expand the engineering and also in applicable technical disciplines internship programs so that you could then bring in people to backfill and then provide some succession planning. So that's the, you know, kind of the bottom line in terms of our findings and recommendations.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug, I think this may be for you, but maybe not. I got a couple questions, if I may, Madam
yes.
Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
How did we get here? Do I remember that over the years we have decreased the number of engineers who have been working at ODOT?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, I think a couple of things have put us in this position. We have less staff than we used to have at ODOT. We've, through a couple of legislative sessions, reduced the number of staff. We, I think another thing is in terms of the compensation, the change in the PERS, at least what I've heard, and this is anecdotal, so I can't prove this, but from what I've heard from the people that have left the department is the change in the retirement system where the salaries were lower There was some offset as people looked at the total compensation, the fact that he had fully paid health insurance, which we still have, and the fact that he had a retirement system, which was a good solid retirement system, and the changes that have happened in the retirement system have, people have looked at that and said, the overall compensation that I'm getting is lower, and so I'm less willing to stay for the same wage. So I think those are probably the two things that I could point to over the past couple of years that have caused that. I would also add that there's the nature of the workforce in general is changing. Younger people treat jobs differently than they did a few years ago, and it appears to be more transient. So the Dye Management Report points out some particular issues, but it's possible that there's also the general sociological issue that's happening about how people think of jobs now that's taking that away from us.
Follow-up? So, Doug, talk with me some about the PEM, and I can't remember what that stands for. Principal Executive Manager. Yeah. Now, how is it that why would those folks have to take a cut in pay?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, on the chart, the program, Professional Engineer 2 series is the top of the technical series. And the principal executive manager, I believe is what the PEM stands for, D, would be, for instance, one of our construction project manager positions. And so as represented positions have experienced salary increases through negotiation, management positions have not had similar increases. In other words, when represented salaries go up, management salaries don't necessarily adjust at the same rate, and that's what you're seeing here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, David, for this explanation. Pardon me?
I was just letting him know that they're in line.
Okay, all right. David, thank you for the explanation, and Doug, thanks for bringing us the study and the report today. David, is your study limited to the principal offices of ODOT, or are these regional shortages as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we looked at the project delivery business line, which I think, as you all know, it includes the region as well as headquarters. So it's across the state, the regions and headquarters.
Follow-up. And so is it uniform regionally that we have these same kinds of shortfalls, deficiencies, and the problems with recruiting, retention, career paths?
Representative Butler, in Region 1, the problem is more acute, especially with the ability, in terms of vacant positions, length of vacancies, and the number of vacancies. But in general, it's statewide, but the most pressing problems are in Region 1.
So systematic is what we're hearing. Additional follow-up, if I may.
Yes.
Are these... when we see the actual replacements of through recruitment and the process of recruiting, do we see that Oregon educated students are applying for those, or are we having to go outside the state for the PEs and the PEMs?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the information that we've seen, and we met with hiring managers and listened to them, is that they will look from wherever they can find suitable candidates, and uniformly we're told that the candidate pools are not what they would like them to be, that they don't have enough qualified candidates, and so the recruiting is the net is being cast as far as it can be cast, but I guess it's not reeling in too many people. In addition to that, the department has been doing some on-campus recruiting, and My recollection is that there's a very small number of actual applicants as a result of that, and I think compensation is an issue. Was a barrier there too.
And Chair Byer, Representative Butler, let me add, we are trying to reinstitute what we call the graduate engineer program, where we go out and start intentionally hire graduating engineers. I believe, if I have these numbers right, we tried to hire 12. I believe we ended up making 8 offers. None. There was no one from the Oregon universities that were interested. And that's for this year.
Follow up, if I may, then. Thank you, Madam Chair. So really, this is part of Oregon's higher education problem as well, that we have less graduating engineers than we used to have, but it's also the fact that the engineers that we've got are taking jobs other than the government jobs that are available through ODOT.
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, I think the number of graduate engineers coming out of, I know Oregon State a little bit better than the other places, but I believe the number of graduate engineers coming out of Oregon State is actually, it's leveled off now. It's up, it's far higher than it was when I was going to school. But I think what you're seeing is that they are placing every engineer, every graduate engineer is getting a job or going on into to higher levels of education. They're just not coming to the Department of Transportation.
Final question in this regard, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for your patience with me as I go through this to see if I can find out what's going on. The factors of wage scale in Oregon. When these folks are looking around, and I have a whole batch of children that are up job looking age and in the employment market, as they're looking around, Oregon wages don't appear to be too bad in relationship to moving back to Oregon. The problem is the high cost of living. Is that, David, in your study, does that come out? Is that demonstrative anywhere where the fact that the same home in Lake Oswego, let's move to Beaverton, the same home in Beaverton or Milwaukee is 400,000 or 500,000, where in another community in Houston, a suburb of Houston, would be less than 200,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I can't speak to the impact of cost of living on this, but what I can speak to is that to a certain extent this is a national problem within the industry. It's driven by nationally overall the sort of graying of the labor force, and in addition to that the large increase in the demand for civil engineering competences over the last 5 to 10 years, so we've got a double hit. So the Texas Department of Transportation is a client of ours, and we're working with on different issues, but I met with their human resource manager about 4 weeks ago, and I just asked them about this because we're working here for you, and they have very similar situation there. That they're finding it difficult to retain their employees after 0 to 10 years because of disparities in compensation, and as they transition to an organization doing a lot of toll projects and those sorts of things, they need higher level employees, and they simply are not able to compete for them in the labor market. And I think the third actually is just we've had a very robust economy, and which has driven up is driving up labor costs.
Madam Chair, I guess I do. That does bring up a final question. That was my final question, yes. But that does bring up a question. Now that you brought Texas back into it, then I'm looking again at the final page of your recommendation of the address, and seeing that those that are represented employees that are overtime eligible look like they're maxing out in the PE2 at about 85,000, and then I can go into a PEM as a project engineer for the magnanimous pay of $72,000 and receive no overtime. Will I find this same disparity when I go to Texas or when I go to any other state?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, in the body of our report, we've got a table that looks at this, and the overlap, and Gary, correct me if I'm wrong, and Gary has kind of crawled through this, we did some benchmarking work and looked at just that very issue, the magnitude of the overlap, and we compared you to Portland Department of Transportation, Multnomah County, Washington County, Caltrans, California, which is the California State Department of Transportation, Washington State Department of Transportation, and I believe that the overlap there ranges from between 2% and 25%.
Some a little more.
A little more. So in our recommendations, we've recommended that you'd seek to have a comparable overlap to those peer agencies. And I don't know what the situation is in Texas, but I know that the reason, if I'm working Region 1 as a PE1 or a PE2 and I want to move up into a management position, it's a jump in pay for me to go and work for Portland Department of Transportation.
I guess, Madam Chair, at that particular point, the representative positions obviously have done much better in the bargaining than the other folks, and as is indicated, if you want upward mobility in this process, you just stay with the representative position and work a little more overtime, and that'll provide it to you. It seems like to me that I haven't studied page 15 where that's at that Gary or David was referring to, but I'm anxious about the fact that what's happened is that we've got these disincentives for folks to move into management positions as a result of whatever reason. But if we're going to be able to attract the best and the brightest, first of all, we've put a lot of money into bringing the folks online. As I look around the table, we've got lots of universities represented here in our communities. We've put a lot of money in trying to get the civil engineers out of those schools, and unfortunately, there's still a lack of them, and part of that's the robust economy. But I would still say that when you look at the cost of living, and particularly when we talk about cost of living, what is it going to take to buy a home in Ashland, Oregon? Versus what's it take to buy a home across the border in another community somewhere else, and maybe not across the border. Maybe to take my civil engineering degree off to Wyoming or to Texas or somewhere else, and yeah, I'll probably make less money as a bring home take home check. But if the price of housing is half as much in Texas as it is in Oregon, then you look at that and say, hey, we're doing pretty good by taking a little less money in another state.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. Has this study been shared with DAS, Department of Administrative Services?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, the study is just completed today, so we will share it with them.
Okay, because it may be my perception, but I think you have to go to them to talk about changes in these, and I'm wondering how much that's a factor in the situation we have right now.
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, we've had some discussions with DAS as we saw the preliminary results of this coming out, and I know that they're interested in what the study is showing, and we will be working with them to see as we develop strategies recommended in here. As we develop strategies, we'll be working with DAS to develop those strategies.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me say thank you to ODOT for bringing the issue forward. After 6 years down in Ways and Means, I always found it refreshing that the Department of Transportation would be proactive in bringing issues forward as they were occurring or before they occurred, rather than having to react to them later on. And so appreciate the work you do. I'd also share with this committee, this issue is not just an ODOT issue. This issue also resides in Oregon's Treasury Department, the AG's office, the Department of Revenue, all throughout the state where we have highly technically skilled individuals. We're all facing this, or all the agencies are facing this. And I want to follow up on Representative Gilman's question. Pay scales for management, those aren't set by the legislature, are they? Those are set by the Department of Administrative Services and the governor's office.
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, I believe that's correct. The legislature does not determine the compensation schedule. I think that's done administratively.
So you're bringing this issue more to us just as a heads up of what you're facing rather than looking for legislative action.
But Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, again, I appreciate you saying that we were proactive in doing it, but it was you guys that asked for it.
Yeah, actually, I was trying to be nice
because I remember that from last session.
So we're trying to be responsive and bring back the what the situation is, so that you're aware of what the challenges that we're facing.
Yeah, you weren't supposed to say that as being nice because I do remember that. share with the committee really quick, gentlemen, what constitutes compensation? So that way I know, and the committee knows, that when you say the state of Oregon's compensation is not comparative to the private sector or other local governments, are we comparing apples to apples?
Representative Smith, Chair Beyer, there's a huge and probably a little unintelligible table in here where we've tried to compare apples to apples. I'm confident that the bottom line conclusions that we've drawn are correct. We may have types of apples. We might not all have, you know, they might all be golden deliciouses.
Yeah.
But, I'm comfortable that we have compared the full range of compensation, which includes, you know, all the benefits.
Okay.
As well as salary.
Just a follow-up. That's an important point. In the state of Oregon, when you look at the compensation in separate from salary, I think in the state of Oregon it's about 44% to 48% for every dollar. It's pretty significant. One last thought, and I just share this as a thought that I know the banking industry is doing in terms of recruitment. They're going out and they're trying to find math graduates, not just CPAs or accountants, and then they're cross-training them. And as an example, in my community, I have a personal friend, close friend of mine, who has a master's degree in advanced math in Heppner High School, taught calculus, geometry, trigonometry, decided teaching math wasn't for him, being a teacher wasn't for him, and started to head to OSU to be an engineer. He never got 3 feet out of the door of the high school before the bank picked him up and said, we like those skills, we're willing to train you. And the next thing you know, rather than becoming a civil engineer, which was truly his intent, he's now going to become a loan officer. And so I wonder if there's other areas of education besides engineering to where you can find quality talent and over a period of time train and utilize them.
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, the recommendation that they have about the on the last page, in fact, I think it's the last very last bullet, the technical discipline internship program, I think sort of speaks to that. If we have positions set aside so that we can bring people in and do that cross training, with the amount of work we have to do, the number of positions and the amount of budget we have, it's kind of a challenge to have a strong training program where you have some people around that are just getting trained. We are looking at with some of the strategies that we're looking at coming out of the recommendations are developing, it's sort of an inverse of that, but kind of developing design teams at universities, and so that maybe we can take a small project and send it down to the university and have them working on it in the same way. Now we'll probably hit more of the engineering types there, but it's still trying to get at that same thing as we look at ways where we can start to build the interest in coming to work for the Department of Transportation.
One last question and I'll be done. Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, as you were looking at the state as a whole, can you talk about the differences you found in regions in terms of recruitment? So was Eastern Oregon different than Southern Oregon, which was different than the metro area?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm the Gary and and myself divided up where we went. So I and we were both in Region 1, and I know from the data that we've gotten, and here we've got a table that that shows, that compares vacancy rates. I know that as we answered prior question, and discussed a little, the problems in Region 1 are particularly acute, probably because of some of the issues around, you know, cost of living, but also that's where the other jobs are, and it's also where there's private sector employment as well as them. Gary, in terms of other parts of the state, are there any other, I guess, any other observations that you've got?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, Region 2 also is experiencing some issues. Region 4 we also went to, and it was representative of the smaller ODOT regions, and it has the cost of living issue. We did not quantify that, but just the qualitative answers that we had from interviewees, that their cost of living for housing as the Central Oregon grows has been a stumbling block in bringing people on board. But that said, Region 4 also has a better retention rate than the other regions.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. I'm Gary Walpotny.
Thank you.
Just, Madam Chair, my last thought, and then I will stay quiet. in my neck of the woods, Region 5, ODOT jobs are viewed as plum jobs. Those are the best jobs in town. And when I look at the example on the last page of a project leader earning approximately $45,000, while I know in the metro area that's a small amount comparative to the industry, in Hefner and LeGrand, in Wallowa County, those are good paying jobs that'll buy a good home and take care of folks. And so while I definitely do see the need and I definitely see the issue, there's also some political reality for some of us in terms of addressing this issue, because $86,000 a year, my goodness, that's a millionaire where we come from.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a series, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Doug, I think this is for you. DAS says that there's a cap on the salary range. I'm looking at this, the thick book here. That is so fascinating that there is a cap on increasing the pay scale of somebody within the organization, but if somebody with the same capability is outside the organization and makes half again as much or twice as much, they can be brought into the organization at the higher salary range. Can you talk about that?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, it's one of the current rules that we're talking to the Department of Administrative Services about to see if there could be some more flexibility brought into that. But it cost us at least one person. The director sitting behind me, this was when he was the region manager in Region 1. We had a very outstanding female employee that wanted to stay with the state, was offered a job for I believe the number was around $88,000 a year outside the state in another governmental agency in Portland, and would have stayed with the state if we could have gotten to about $72,000 a year. And because she was a current employee with the state, we couldn't get to $72,000 a year. There are certain rules that you have to live by, and again, we're working with DAS to try and build in the flexibility so that we can deal with that particular issue.
Follow up.
So if I understand it correctly, she'd taken a job at this other place making $88,000 a year, and the next month or 2 months later came and applied at ODOT?
No, I'm sorry, Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, she was an ODOT employee.
I know, but if she took the job...
She would have stayed at ODOT if we could have offered her the money, but we couldn't, and so she went outside.
I know, but my question is, if she took the job outside and then applied later to come back at ODOT at the higher salary she could have been hired?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, I believe that's correct. She would have got not at the same $88,000, but I believe that that would have enabled her to be at the $72,000 or whatever but the number was. Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just comment, one of the things that you mentioned in your report is the morale. I mean, think what that does to their morale if they think I've been a loyal employee, but you're not going to compensate me as much as somebody with equal qualifications who comes from outside. You'll give them half again as much. This is just outrageous, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing did come to mind as we've discussed the issue, and I appreciate Doug bringing it up, and that is, Doug, you have gone more to the design build, and you indicated that you are going to actually some of the campuses for some of that. Make a need for fewer of the people in the department if you're actually going to design, build, and other locations?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, it changes the type of person we're hiring. We still need to maintain some expertise, but since we're not doing all the work, we don't have to have the body of expertise that we used to have. That, in fact, is how we were able to do such a significantly larger program without expanding the number of people in the department.
And finally, if I may, Madam Chair, just for my own records, when we're talking about represented salaries of that group of AEs and PEs, who are the unions that are represented? SEIU?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, those are Association of Engineering Employee Represented Classifications. Association of Engineering Employees, AEE.
AEE, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've talked about this issue. This issue even goes further than that. We've got our executive director, Matt Garrett. We're blessed to have him. We're not going to keep him for probably a couple more years. He's going to be gone at a much, much higher pay. And I hate to see that. I think the world of the fella, but all you have to do is look at his predecessor, who, after 5-6 years, had an opportunity to almost double his salary up in Portland, and he was gone. And you can't blame folks for that. And again, the same issue lies in many other agencies. And at some point in time, this body and is going to have to come to the conclusion that if we want talent and we want to keep the talent that we have, that we're going to have to compensate for it. And we've got some pretty good folks out there that potentially we're going to lose over the next couple of years. This is a real issue.
Thank you. Did I cut you off?
No. But in speaking to Representative Smith's comments, Madam Chair, there are members of the House that sit currently on the House floor that do not want state employees, any state employee, to make more than the governor makes.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Right.
Because we have had employees, and you mentioned the treasurer's office. I think you may have heard the same story that I heard. Well, this may have been a year or two before your time, Representative, but we had people in the treasurer's office that were so experienced that they could have gotten jobs outside in industry outside at as much as 10 times the salaries, and yet really enjoyed the people that they were working with and really enjoyed sticking around and you know, had a nice home in Salem and could walk to work in effect in the morning. And really enjoy it. This is a great place to live. Up until the time I became a state representative, I'd never set foot in the capital of the state of Oregon. And since I've been here, I recognize now why people love to come and live in the Portland and Salem metropolitan area. But you can't always do that. You can't always do that if you're going to hold the compensation for these better educated and better trained folks down.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess following up a little bit on what Representative, Butler?
Buckley.
And maybe this is more towards you, but new employees, we were talking about sending jobs out for private businesses to negotiate with the state. And some of those people, I mean, they hire young, less experienced engineers. And I'm very concerned about that new employees have less experience, 50% under 10 years with ODOT. That people learn with experience. And one of the things that's quoted in here is that what looks like a good design, with experience, you may realize is not a good design. So it's experience, I think, that is so important in ODOT that we keep and retain, and that when we lose that, we really lose an important resource.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The funding of these positions, the vast majority of that is funded through the gas tax?
Chair Byer, Representative Smith, yeah, it's a highway fund, so it's gas tax, sure. Vehicle reg, and the equivalent weight mile fees, or heavy vehicle fees.
Okay. So just as a follow-up, there's no general fund argument in terms of why we're not providing additional staffing or compensation increases to the department. These are other funds that would have no effect on education, public safety, or human services. And so
that's correct.
While other agencies may have to duke it out and arm wrestle, there is an opportunity to solve a problem within the Oregon Department of Transportation if the Ways and Means folks in DAS could come to an agreement.
Thank you. Well, and on that one, I mean, I agree with you, but I also know that there's a definite effort to for the department to keep as much money in the roads where people want it. So there are a couple of competing interests there. And I guess my question is, when we went with the bridge delivery plan that we went with, and we have plenty of competition out there for our employees, but did this exasperate the problem?
Exasperate. You got it.
I got it.
Exasperate.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I mean, you increase the volume of work being done, and that delivery method compresses it, so there's more demand for labor. So, and we didn't analyze it, but undoubtedly you've created more demand for labor, and where do you go to? You go to the weather of skilled people. So yes, but that's because you've condensed, and by the nature of that type of delivery method, you've gotten the project done quicker, so it sort of compacted it up. Yes.
And I guess my question would be, are more areas doing that type of projects now as opposed to trying to do them in-house?
Madam Chair, that's the trend nationally, is to have different types of delivery methods, whether it's design build or that type of program management. But in general, I think as you look around the country, what we're seeing is a lot of debt-financed projects, and to deliver them quickly to address the backlog of needs, how you do it is through these what in the past were called non-traditional delivery methods, whether it's program management, design, build, and we're seeing it nationally, and that's why, you know, nationally there's a much larger volume of highway work taking place, which is creating the national shortage of labor, in part, is contributing to it.
Thank you. Well, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you to the department, and David and Gary, thank you for your report. It's just what we wanted, and we'd heard little tidbits that indicated there was a situation. This really qualifies it, and we appreciate the information.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to one last thought, and that is I'm a firm believer that you get what you pay for, and I've always found in business that when I pay for experienced personnel, I tend to get a higher quality product delivered on time, and usually at a lower cost. And, you know, Doug, I would contend you're probably as efficient as three or four brand new engineers coming out of the door. And so we would be better off to pay Mr. Tyndall an extra $20,000-$30,000 than to have to go out and hire two engineers. Well, this is just basic economics. And so when the legislature says, you know, we've got to keep putting that money into infrastructure,
Well, part of that infrastructure, part of our asset is our personnel. So often business fails and makes the mistake that personnel is an expense. Personnel is not an expense. Personnel is an asset. And the more you nurture that asset, the more it's going to pay off for you. And I think we'd be penny wise and pound foolish if we didn't take this report and if we didn't act on it and we didn't recognize that it's by getting the best and brightest is where the state of Oregon's going to save the most money, and they're going to get the biggest bang for their buck, and they're going to get more pavement put on the ground. They're going to do it on time and efficiently. That's my tirade. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just want to add real quick that I do want to recognize that we have gone through numerous years of budgeting issues and trying to squeeze departments and dissatisfaction maybe with department heads that would lead to reductions in their workforce and I think that this all probably has just added up over a number of years, and while it sounds like that's happening everywhere, that everybody's having the workforce issues, I think as a body we have to kind of accept a little bit of the responsibility for that. And thank you, gentlemen, for coming. We're glad that we could get together on your schedule, and we appreciate your product. And committee, we are adjourned, and I will see you Monday.